Professor Noam Chomsky. An introduction.
The issues that I would like to discuss in these lectures are rooted in the nature of Western industrial societies. In these capitalist democracies, there's a certain tension, perhaps even a contradiction, with regard to where power is located. In a democracy, the people rule, at least in principle. But decision-making power over large areas of social life resides in private hands, and that has a major spillover effect throughout the social order. One way to resolve the tension would be to extend the democratic system to investment, organization of work, and so on. That would be a major social revolution, which, in my view at least, would realize some of the libertarian principles on which the political revolutions of the 18th century were partially founded. Or the tension could be resolved, and sometimes is, by eliminating public interference with state and private power. In the advanced industrial societies, the problem is typically approached by more moderate means, by measures to deprive democratic political structures of substantive content while leaving them formally intact. A large part of this task is assumed by ideological institutions. They have the job of channeling thought and attitudes within acceptable bounds, deflecting any potential challenge to established privilege and authority before it can take form and gather strength. This enterprise has many facets and agents. Here I'm going to be primarily concerned with one aspect, thought control, as conducted through the agency of the national media and related elements of the elite intellectual culture. I'll be speaking primarily of the United States, which I know best, but I think that the comments generalize reasonably well to other industrial societies as well. In my opinion, there's much too little inquiry into these matters. My feeling is that citizens of the democratic societies should undertake a course of what we might call intellectual self-defense to protect themselves from manipulation and control and to lay the basis for more meaningful democracy. It's this concern that motivates my comments here.
On Ideas, the 1988 Massey Lectures about Media, Propaganda, and Democracy. A series of five talks, one each night this week, divided into 16 sections, including questions from a panel of distinguished Canadian journalists. The Massey Lectures are an annual event on CBC Radio. They began in 1961 and have featured leading figures in literature and politics, religion and the arts, including Northrop Frye, Jane Jacobs, Carlos Fuentes, Paul Goodman, Claude Lévi-Strauss, C.B. McPherson, Martin Luther King Jr., and Doris Lessing. The 1988 Massey Lectures are given by Noam Chomsky, Institute Professor in the Departments of Philosophy and Linguistics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in Boston. Professor Chomsky is an internationally renowned scholar, the leading theorist in the field of structural linguistics, and the author of some 30 books, both technical books in the field of linguistics and books addressed to a general audience, which examine political issues, focusing especially on the place of the United States in international affairs. He is particularly concerned with what Americans find out through their mass media, more properly called, in Professor Chomsky's view, the elite media. His approach to this question involves a massive amount of research. His books are noted for the mountain of data they contain. In September 1988, his latest book, co-authored with Professor Edward Herman, was published by Pantheon. It's called Manufacturing Consent. Some of the raw material for the conclusions he draws in these Massey lectures can be found in that book, which is in bookstores and libraries now. Throughout his work, Professor Chomsky has based his conclusions on a close analysis of specific cases, but his real interest is in the larger issues that the specific cases point to. What are the enduring institutional characteristics of our media system, the system we call the free press, and how do those characteristics affect what we think we know? A half century ago, John Dewey observed that criticism of specific abuses has only limited value. The only really fundamental approach to the problem, Dewey said, is to inquire concerning the necessary effect of the present economic system upon the whole system of what he called publicity, upon the judgment of what news is, upon the selection and elimination of matter that is published, upon the treatment of news in both news and editorial columns. The question under this mode of approach is not how many specific abuses there are and how they may be remedied, but how far genuine intellectual freedom and social responsibility are possible on any large scale under the existing economic regime. The philosopher and theologian Reinhold Niebuhr concluded that ordinary people were hardly capable of understanding the world or drawing reasonable conclusions without being subjected to a set of what he called necessary illusions, what we'd call propaganda, constructed by the intellectual elites. The system for managing this has turned out to be the mass media. The title of the 1988 Massey Lectures is Necessary Illusions. Noam Chomsky.
Let me begin with a report in a church-based Latin American journal, datelined São Paulo, Brazil. The headline reads, Brazilian Bishops Support Plan to Democratize Media. The report describes a proposal, which is now being debated in the Brazilian Constituent Assembly, that would open up Brazil's powerful and highly concentrated media to citizen participation. Brazil's Catholic bishops are among the principal advocates of this legislative proposal to democratize the country's communications media. The report points out that Brazilian TV is in the hands of five big networks, while eight huge multinational corporations and some state enterprises account for most communications advertising. The current proposal calls for a National Communications Council that would be made up of civilian and government representatives and would develop a democratic communications policy. The questions raised by the Brazilian bishops are being seriously discussed in many parts of the world. There are projects underway in several Latin American countries and elsewhere as well. There has been discussion of what's been called a New World Information Order. The idea is to diversify media access, to encourage alternatives to the global media system, which is under the overwhelming dominance of the Western industrial powers. An inquiry into such possibilities by UNESCO elicited an extremely hostile reaction in the United States and contributed to the near demise of the organization. The alleged concern was freedom of the press. One question I'd like to raise in these lectures is just how serious this concern is and what, in fact, it comes to, what's its substantive content. Further questions that lie in the background have to do with what a democratic communications policy would be and whether it's a good idea, and if so, whether it's an attainable concept. And more generally, just what kind of democratic order is it to which we aspire? The concept of democratizing the media has no real meaning within the terms of political discourse in the United States. In fact, the phrase has a paradoxical or even vaguely subversive ring to it. Citizen participation would be considered an infringement on freedom of the press. It would be considered a blow struck against the independence of the media that would distort the mission that they have undertaken to inform the public without fear or favor. Now, that reaction merits some thought. Underlying it are beliefs as to how the media do function and also as to how they should function within our democratic systems. There are also certain implicit conceptions of the nature of democracy. Let's have a look at these topics in turn. The standard image of media performance was expressed by Judge Gerfein in a decision in which he rejected efforts by the U.S. government to bar publication of the Pentagon Papers. In that decision, he said that we have a cantankerous press, an obstinate press, a ubiquitous press, and it must be suffered by those in authority in order to preserve the even greater values of freedom of expression and the right of the people to know. Columnist Anthony Lewis of the New York Times commented on this decision and pointed out that the media were not always as independent, vigilant, and defiant of authority as they are today. But, he says, in the Vietnam and Watergate eras, the media learned to exercise the power to root about in our national life, exposing what they deem right for exposure without regard to external pressures. That, too, is a commonly held belief. There has been much debate about the media during this period, but it does not deal with the problem of democratizing the media and freeing them from the constraints of state and private power. Rather, the issue that is debated is whether the media have not exceeded proper bounds in escaping such constraints. The question is whether they have perhaps even threatened the existence of democratic institutions in their contentious and irresponsible defiance of authority. There was an important study on these topics by the Trilateral Commission in 1975. It was a study on what they called governability of democracies, and the commission, which is made up of elite elements from Japan, the United States, and Europe, the commission concluded that the media have become a notable new source of national power. This, they said, is one aspect of an excess of democracy that contributes to the reduction of governmental authority at home and a consequent decline in the influence of democracy abroad. This general crisis of democracy, the commission held, results from the efforts of previously marginalized sectors of the population to organize and to press their demands. By doing so, they create an overload that prevents the democratic process from functioning properly. The American commentator Samuel Huntington, a professor at Harvard University, pointed out that in earlier times, President Truman had been able to govern the country with the cooperation of a relatively small number of Wall Street lawyers and bankers. In this period, then, there was no crisis of democracy. But in the 1960s, the crisis developed and reached serious proportions. The Trilateral Commission study, therefore, urges more moderation in democracy to mitigate what they call the excess of democracy and thus overcome the crisis. Putting it in plain terms, the general public must be reduced to their traditional apathy and obedience and driven from the arena of political debate and action if democracy is to survive. This study reflects the perceptions and values of liberal elites from the United States, Europe, and Japan. It includes the leading figures of the Carter administration, President Carter himself, in fact. On the right, the perception is that democracy is threatened by the organizing efforts of those groups that are called the special interests. That's an interesting concept of contemporary political rhetoric. It refers to workers, farmers, women, youth, the elderly, the handicapped, ethnic minorities, in fact, to the general population. In the U.S. presidential campaigns of the 1980s, the Democrats were accused of being the instrument of these special interests and therefore undermining the national interest. What is the national interest? Well, the tacit assumption is that the national interest is represented by the one notable sector that was omitted from the list of special interests, corporations, financial institutions, and other business elites. They represent the national interest. The charge that the Democrats represent the special interests has little merit. Rather, they represent other elements of the national interest, and they participated with few qualms in the so-called right turn of the post-Vietnam era among elite groups. This right turn had a number of different aspects. It included the dismantling of the limited state programs that were designed to protect the poor and deprived, the transfer of resources to the wealthy, the conversion of the state, even more than before, into a welfare state for the privileged, and the expansion of state power and the protected state sector of the economy through the military system. The military system, domestically in the United States, is in fact a device for compelling the public to subsidize high technology industry and to provide a state-guaranteed market for high technology waste production. A related element of the right turn was a more activist foreign policy. The goal was to extend U.S. power through subversion, international terrorism, and aggression, what's called the Reagan Doctrine, which the media characterize as the vigorous defense of democracy worldwide. In general, the Democratic opposition offered qualified support to these programs of the Reagan administration, And the fact of the matter is that they were largely an extrapolation of initiatives of the Carter years, and with very few exceptions, were strongly opposed by the general population. And that's a fact that's very clearly shown by polling results during this period. One should not be misled by Reagan's landslide electoral victories. In fact, Reagan won the votes of under a third of the electorate, and of the voters, a clear majority hoped that his legislative programs would not be enacted. Meanwhile, half the population continue to hold that the government is run by a few big interests looking out for themselves, as polls regularly show. The Reagan phenomena, in fact, may offer a kind of foretaste of where capitalist democracies are moving in general, with a number of crucial features: the elimination of labor unions, of independent media, of political associations, and more generally the elimination of forms of popular organization that interfere with domination of the state by concentrated private power. Well, let's return to the media, which are charged with having fanned the ominous flames of excess of democracy. The Trilateral Commission concludes, I'm now quoting them, that broader interests of society and government require that if journalists do not impose standards of professionalism upon themselves, then the alternative could well be regulation by the government to the end of restoring a balance between government and media. Others have had similar concerns. The executive director of Freedom House, Leonard Sussman, asks the question, must free institutions be overthrown because of the very freedom they sustain? He, too, is referring to the allegedly adversarial behavior of the media. John Roach, who's the intellectual in residence during the Johnson administration, he answers Sussman's question by calling for congressional investigation of the workings of these private governments, who he claims distorted the record so grossly in their anti-Johnson mission. However, he fears that Congress is too terrified of the media to undertake this urgent task. Both Sussman and Roach are commenting on a two-volume study of media coverage of the Tet Offensive of 1968, sponsored by Freedom House, written by Peter Braestrup, journalist. This study has been widely hailed as a landmark contribution. John Roach described it as one of the major pieces of investigative reporting and first-rate scholarship of the past quarter century. He calls it a meticulous case study of media incompetence, if not malevolence. This classic of modern scholarship is alleged to have demonstrated that in their incompetent and biased coverage, reflecting the adversary culture of the 60s, the media lost the war in Vietnam. They therefore harmed the cause of democracy and freedom, for which the United States fought in vain. This Freedom House study concludes that these failures reflect the more volatile journalistic style that has become so popular since the late 1960s, and they go on to say that it is accompanied with an often mindless readiness to seek out conflict, to believe the worst of the government or of authority in general, and on that basis to divide up the actors on any issue into the good and the bad, where the bad actors include the U.S. forces in Vietnam, the military-industrial complex, the CIA, and the U.S. government generally, and the good in the eyes of the media are presumably the communists, who were consistently overpraised and protected, so the Freedom House study claims. There is, in fact, a striking and interesting aspect of the reporting of the Tet Offensive. Up until the Tet Offensive, the media had typically reported the war as the American command wanted them to see it. Journalists were taken on guided tours. There were very few that did anything different from that, and they presented the war as perceived under the control of the American military. But during the Tet Offensive, that didn't work. The war was all around them. They could look out the windows of their hotels and see fighting, and they saw that it was a very different war than the one that they had been programmed to present. In that respect, coverage of the Tet Offensive was different, but only in that respect. It's by now an established truth that it's almost inescapable that such broad coverage will undermine support for the war effort, particularly the often gory pictorial reportage by television. I'm now quoting from Landrum Balling, who's speaking in a conference that he directed on the media The conference was devoted to the question of whether there is indeed no way to effect some kind of balance between the advantages a totalitarian government enjoys because of its ability to control or black out unfavorable news and warfare, and the disadvantages for the free society of allowing open coverage of all the wartime events. The Watergate affair, in which investigative reporting helped force a president from office, as Anthony Lewis points out, that reinforced these dire images of impending destruction of democracy by the freewheeling, independent, and adversarial media. The Iran-Contra scandal contributed to these images. Two kinds of questions arise in connection with these vigorous debates about the media and democracy. The first are questions of fact, the second are questions of value. The basic question of fact is whether the media have indeed adopted an adversarial stance, perhaps with excessive zeal, whether in particular they undermine the defense of freedom in wartime and threaten free institutions by flagellating ourselves and those in power. If that turns out to be true as a matter of fact, we may then ask a further question. Would it be proper to impose some external constraints to ensure that the media keep to the bounds of responsibility? Now, the question of fact, which is, of course, fundamental, is rarely argued. The case is assumed to have been proven. There are some, however, who have argued that the factual premises are simply false. Let's begin with the broadest claims. Let's have a look at the functioning of the so-called free market of ideas. There's an interesting study by Benjamin Ginsberg of the mobilization of popular opinion to promote state power, and after reviewing many features of this, he concludes that, I'm now quoting Ginsberg, he concludes that the marketplace of ideas built during the 19th and 20th centuries effectively disseminates the beliefs and ideas of the upper classes while subverting the ideological and cultural independence of the lower classes. Through the construction of this marketplace, Western governments forged firm and enduring links between socioeconomic position and ideological power. They've therefore permitted upper classes to use each to buttress the other. In the United States in particular, the ability of the upper and middle classes to dominate the marketplace of ideas has generally allowed these strata to shape the entire society's perception of political reality and the range of realistic political and social possibilities. While Westerners usually equate the marketplace with freedom of opinion, the hidden hand of the market can be almost as potent an instrument of control as the iron fist of the state. Now, these conclusions have some initial plausibility on guided free market assumptions that are not particularly controversial. Segments of the media that can reach a substantial audience are major corporations, closely integrated with even larger conglomerates. Like other businesses, they sell a product to buyers. The market to which they sell is advertisers, and the product is audiences, with a bias towards more wealthy audiences, which improve advertising rates. So, in effect, the media are major corporations selling privileged audiences to other businesses. It would hardly come as a surprise if the picture of the world they present were to reflect the perspectives and the interests of the sellers, the buyers, and the product. Furthermore, those who occupy managerial positions in the media or gain status within them as commentators belong to the same privileged elites, and it would be reasonable to expect that they would share the perceptions, aspirations, and attitudes of their associates. These reflect their own class interests as well. Journalists entering the system are unlikely to make their way unless they conform to these ideological pressures. Generally, they conform by internalizing the values. It's not easy to say one thing and believe another, and those who fail to conform will tend to be weeded out by familiar mechanisms. There are many other factors that induce the media to conform to the requirements of the state-corporate nexus. To confront power is costly and difficult. High standards of evidence and argument are imposed, and critical analysis will naturally not be welcomed by those who are in a position to react vigorously and to determine the array of rewards and punishments. Conformity to a patriotic agenda, in contrast, imposes no such costs. Charges against official enemies barely require substantiation. They're also protected from correction. A correction can always be dismissed as apologetics for the criminals. Someone who attributes the best intentions to the United States, while perhaps deploring failure and ineptitude, requires no evidence for this stance. So, for example, no evidence is required when we ask why success has continued to elude us in the Third World. Why cannot a nation of such vast wealth, power, and good intentions accomplish its purposes more promptly and more effectively? I'm again quoting Landrum Bolling.